the case for creation that can be made entirely apart from the words of the Bible. In fact, we're going to be using primarily the words of authorities in evolution to support the scientific case for creation. And I want to begin, first of all, by pointing out that there is no scientific evidence in the present world and the present processes and systems of this world to support evolution. But let me read first a reference from one of the books that has been written against the creation movement. In the past few years, there have been about 40 of these books. This is one of the most widely read ones by Dr. D.J. Fatima, called Science on Trial. And in this book, he says this statement we agree with. He says, creation and evolution between them exhaust the possible explanations for the origin of living things. Organisms either appeared on the earth fully developed or they did not. If they did not, they must have developed from pre-existing species by some process of modification. If they did appear in a fully developed state, they must indeed have been created by some omnipotent intelligence. And that's the end of his quote, and of course he points out there that these are the only two options, either creation or evolution. That is, we can either explain all things in terms of present processes that are still going on and that we can observe in operation today, or we cannot do that. If we cannot explain everything in terms of continuing present processes, then the basic systems of the world must be explained by processes completed in the past that are not natural processes, but supernatural processes. And so you can see that evidence can either be given in favor of creation or opposed to evolution, and it amounts to the same thing, because these are the only two possibilities. So we can either speak of the scientific case for creation or the scientific case against evolution. And it's a little easier to do the latter, because if evolution is true, it ought to be still going on and we ought to be able to see it. The fact is, we don't see it. In the present world, nobody ever sees evolution taking place. Now, let me give another quotation. This one from Dr. L. Harrison Matthews, who's a fellow of the Royal Society in England. This is in the introduction to the 1971 edition of Charles Darwin's Origin of Species. Now, of course, Darwin doesn't revise his book anymore, but every once in a while a new edition comes out with a new foreword, putting it in the current context. And in this one, published in 1971, this leading evolutionary zoologist, Dr. Matthews, says this. He says, in accepting evolution as a fact, how many biologists have paused to reflect that science is built upon theories that have been proved by experiment to be correct? Or how many remember that the theory of animal evolution has never been thus proved? The fact of evolution is the backbone of biology, and biology is thus in the peculiar position of being a science founded on an unproved theory. Is it then a science or a faith? Belief in the theory of evolution, he says, is thus exactly parallel to belief in special creation. Both are concepts which believers know to be true, but neither up to the present has been capable of proof. That's the end of his quote. So evolution and creation are on the same basis. They can both be discussed scientifically, but neither one can be proved scientifically, or disproved, for that matter, scientifically, because we cannot repeat the past. And whether the present world came about by creation or evolution in the past, we cannot see it happening in the present, and therefore it's not capable of scientific proof in the sense of being able to observe either one taking place in the laboratory. Obviously, creation doesn't take place today by the very nature of the assumption that God created everything in the past. Evolution is supposed to be taking place today, but evolutionists say it goes so slow you can't see it, so neither one can be tested in the laboratory, and therefore in the last analysis they have to be appropriated by faith. Both of them do. Either one of them does. However, we believe that the scientific evidence that we do have is much better explained in terms of creation than evolution. At any rate, keep in mind that no one ever sees evolution take place in the present. As long as people have been observing plants and animals, living, dying, we've seen many different varieties develop. It doesn't take millions of years to develop a new variety of rose or a new variety of dog or something like that. But nobody ever sees one kind of organism change into another kind. And the quote from Dr. David Kitts at the University of Oklahoma. This is a man that we had a debate with a number of years ago, creation-evolution debate. And in the journal Evolution, Dr. Kitts wrote this. In fact, this was after our debate. He says, evolution, at least in the sense that Darwin speaks of it, cannot be detected. within the lifetime of a single observer. So you can't see evolution taking place. Dr. Kitts admits that. And yet science is supposed to be what we can see. The essence of the scientific method should be observation, experimentation, and the repeatability of the experiments. But no one's ever seen evolution take place, so there's no scientific evidence of evolution. If there were, we could see it happening. Now, here's a statement from Dr. Colin Patterson of the British Museum of Natural History. Dr. Patterson is one of the world's leading authorities on evolution. He's written a very widely used textbook on the subject, has edited their journal on evolution over there, and is head of their paleontology section at the British Museum, one of the great evolutionary institutions of the world. But he said this in 1982 in an interview on the British Broadcasting Corporation network. He said, "No one has ever produced a species by mechanisms of natural selection. No one has ever gotten near to it." Most of the current argument, he says, in neo-Darwinism is about this question: how does a species originate? And it's there that natural selection seems to be fading out, and chance mechanisms of one sort or another are being invoked. Now, you know, Darwin was supposed to have solved the mystery of origins 125 years ago when he wrote his famous book, The Origin of Species by Natural Selection. But as many people have pointed out, in that entire book by Darwin, a world-shaking book, if there ever was one, he never cited one example of a new species originating by natural selection. And evolutionists for 125 years since, thousands of them, spending millions of dollars, doing all kinds of experiments in the laboratory, have been trying to find how to develop new species, and as Dr. Patterson says, no one has ever done it yet. No one's ever seen it happen. No one's ever been able to produce it. By all the artificial pressures they can impose on systems, no one's ever been able to produce a new species. He says, goes on quoting now again from Dr. Patterson, "All that anyone can ever learn from about the history of life is learned from systematics, from the groupings one finds in nature. The rest of it is simply storytelling of one sort or another. We have access to the tips of the tree, but the tree itself is theory, and people who pretend to know about the tree and to describe what went on with it, how the branches came off and the twigs came off, are, I think, telling stories." Once again, evolution does not occur in the present so far as anybody's ever seen. On the other hand, what changes do take place in the present seem to be in the wrong direction. We've seen many evidences of harmful mutations take place and atrophy take place and deterioration take place, even extinctions. Do you know that they estimate that at least one species becomes extinct every year, and this has been going on through all history? Thousands and thousands of species have become extinct throughout history, throughout human history, but not one new species has ever evolved during history. This is strange if evolution is really the way things happen. If it's really the law of life, it's going in the wrong direction. Well, we say that the reason no one's ever seen a new species come into existence is because they don't. They are permanent. They were created in the beginning, and they may go downhill, but they can't go uphill. And after all this time of trying to learn how evolution works, nobody even yet knows how it happens. Now let me quote from Dr. Keith Stewart Thompson in The American Scientist, an article entitled The Meanings of Evolution. This was written as an article against the creation movement. And he says, "Today we're less confident and the whole subject is in the most exciting ferment. Evolution is both troubled from without by the nagging insistence of anti-scientists." And that is his euphemism for creationists. "The nagging insistence of anti-scientists, and nagged from within by the troubling complexities of genetic and developmental mechanisms and new questions about the central mystery, speciation itself. The central mystery of biology is speciation. How does a new species originate? And after all these millions of dollars and thousands of scientists and 125 years of trying to determine the mechanism of speciation, even yet nobody knows how evolution works." Now, this seems like an amazing thing. If evolution is a sure fact of science, as they tell our young people in the school, then at least it ought to be observable. Somebody ought to see it happen once in a while or have some idea how it happens. But nobody's ever seen it happen. Nobody knows how it happens. And yet they insist that it does happen and has happened, and everybody has to believe it. Well, this is not science. In other words, the scientific case is completely against evolution taking place in the present. On the other hand, what we do see in the present, horizontal changes within the kinds of different varieties of dogs, different varieties of cats, and so forth, and gaps between the kinds, and whenever there are any really vertical changes, they go downhill towards disorder and atrophy and maybe death and extinction, not uphill, towards higher complexity. What we do see is exactly what we would expect to see and predict to see if the basic kinds of organisms were created in the past by supernatural processes by the creator of life. What we do see is exactly what we would expect to see in the creation model. And therefore, this is a very strong case, scientific case, for creation. Now, when we tell evolution something like this, they say, well, you have to understand the types of changes that you want to talk about in evolution. These take millions of years, and we don't have time to observe this change taking place for a million years. So then we say, well, where do we go to see that kind of a change, that kind of proof, that kind of evidence? And they say, you go to the fossil record, the record of life in the past. And once again, instead of using the scriptures as the basis for our case for creation, we're using the statements of authorities in evolution. And I'd like to begin by quoting Dr. Pierre Grasset, who was one of the world's leading evolutionary zoologists. He held the chair of evolution at the great Sorbonne University in Paris for some 30 years. And he wrote a very important book entitled Evolution of Living Organisms. In this country, it was published in New York in 1977 by the Wiley Company. And he said this: naturalists must remember that the process of evolution is revealed only through fossil forms. A knowledge of paleontology is therefore a prerequisite. Only paleontology can provide them with the evidence of evolution and reveal its course or mechanisms. And we pointed out that there's no evidence of evolution in the present world. There are horizontal changes within limits, but no increased complexity, no kind evolves into a higher kind in the present order of things or in all human history. And so, as Dr. Grasset says, we can't see that kind of evidence today. In fact, he thinks evolution has stopped now and only took place in the past. Well, he says you have to go to the fossil record. These are the bones and shells and tracks and other remains of former living things that lived in past times and have now been preserved for us in the sedimentary rocks of the crust of the earth. These rocks were once loose sediments which were transported mostly by water, deposited, hardened into rock, and in the process, if there were animals or plants trapped in the sediments, they became buried and then compacted and finally lithified or converted into stone. And these are what we now dig up as fossils, and the idea is that this fossil record of the past shows the development, the evolution of life over the past geological ages, over perhaps several billion years of Earth history. And so they say, even though we can't see it in the present taking place, because it goes very slowly, we can see the results of it in the record of the past. Well, that's what we want to look at today. Can we really see evidence of evolution in the fossils, in the rocks of the past? Or, on the other hand, is what we see in the fossil record what we'd expect to see if things had been specially created? Once again, if things were specially created, each organism with its own structure, designed for its own purpose, ability to vary horizontally within its kind, to adapt to different environments, but only within limits so that it could never be converted into some different kind or higher kind, then we would expect to see the same kind of evidence in the fossils, too. That is, horizontal changes, but complete gaps between the kinds, no real evolutionary transitions between the basic kinds of life in the fossil record any more than in the present. Well, what do we find in the fossil record? Well, first of all, let's point out that in the so-called oldest rocks, or the rocks very down at the very bottom, the crystalline basement rocks, there are no fossils because they are not sedimentary rocks. As you go up, though, above the crystalline basement rocks, you begin to find sedimentary rocks. And supposedly these are the oldest sedimentary rocks, and so they ought to have the oldest forms of life. And we do find in a number of rock formations very simple life forms, one-cell bacteria, one-cell organisms of various kinds. And then later we find, or in other rock formations, we find a complex array of marine invertebrate fossils, things like starfish and sponges and jellyfish, brachiopods, trilobites, and worms, many other kinds of marine invertebrate fossils. but we find no transitions between the one-cell organisms of the so-called Precambrian rocks before the Cambrian rocks, where we find these complex many-celled invertebrate fossils. Now, let me quote here from the standard textbook, Stratigraphy and Life History, by Dr. Marshall Kay and Edwin Colbert, two of the greatest authorities in this field. And they say the introduction of a variety of organisms in the early Cambrian, including such complex forms of the arthropods as the trilobites, and by the way, the eye of the trilobites, supposedly one of the very oldest forms of life, is as complex as any other eye in all creation, including even the human eye. He says, that's surprising. The introduction of abundant organisms in the record would not be so surprising if they were simple. But why should such complex organic forms be in rocks about 600 million years old and be absent or unrecognized in the records of the preceding 2 billion years? If there has been evolution of life, the absence of the requisite fossils in the rocks older than the Cambrian is puzzling. It's not puzzling to the creationists. That's exactly what we'd expect. One-celled organisms and many-celled organisms, but gaps between those with no transitional forms. That's exactly what we find. And it is amazing that in all the billions of one-celled organisms that have been found and the billions of many-celled organisms that have been found, there are no intermediate forms showing how the one-celled organisms ever evolved into any one of these very complex marine invertebrate fossils. And then from the marine invertebrate fossils to the fish, the vertebrate, marine vertebrate fossils, once again, there's a complete absence of any transition from the organisms with hard parts on the outside, that is, shells and so on, the invertebrates, to the those with hard parts on the inside, that is, the vertebrates, fishes, and then higher vertebrates. For example, an article from Dr. Errol White in the Proceedings of the Linnaean Society of London, he's dealing particularly with lungfishes here, and he says that like all the other groups of fishes, the origin of these lungfishes are masked in obscurity. Don't know how. He says the lungfishes, like every other major groups of fishes that I know of, have their origins firmly based in nothing. This is a matter of hot dispute among the experts trying to explain why, but he says each of them is firmly convinced that everybody else is wrong. And so there's no transitional form from the invertebrate to the vertebrate, and yet there must have been literally millions of transitional forms to get from one type to the other, if evolution is really true and if that's how they came about. But they never found any. And as you go higher up, say from the fishes to the amphibians, well, let me quote here from an article by Hobson and Radinsky in Paleobiology in 1980. They say the oldest known tetrapods, that is, the amphibians, the ichthyostegid amphibians of the late Devonian, though first reported on in 1932 and represented by numerous specimens, have never been completely described. No clearly intermediate form in the fish tetrapod transition has ever been discovered. So there are no transitions from the fishes to the amphibians. Now, we don't have time to document this at length here, but it can be documented very thoroughly. There are no transitions from the amphibian to the reptile, from the reptile to the mammal, from the reptile to the bird, from the mammal to human, from the ape to man. With respect to that last, let me just give one reference from Dr. Solly Zuckerman, Lord Zuckerman it is actually, in his book Beyond the Ivory Tower. He says this, in the interpretation of man's fossil history, to the faithful anything is possible. Where the ardent believer is sometimes able to believe several contradictory things at the same time. Then he says, no scientist can logically dispute the proposition that man evolved from some ape-like creature without leaving any fossil traces of the steps of the transformation. So he believes that man evolved from an ape-like creature, but there are no fossil traces of that. There are no intermediate forms. Now, as I say, we don't have time to document this in detail, but let me just give one summary statement here from Dr. Stephen Stanley, great paleontologist at Johns Hopkins University. Summarizing all of it, he says, the known fossil record fails to document a single example of phyletic evolution accomplishing a major morphological transition. There's not a single example. Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, probably the most articulate evolutionist, leading evolutionist in the country today, says, in paleobiology, at the higher level of evolutionary transition between basic morphological designs, Gradualism has always been in trouble. Smooth intermediates between Bauplanen, that is, basic structural designs, are almost impossible to construct even in thought experiments. There is certainly no evidence for them in the fossil record. Now, some people would say, well, what about Archaeopteryx? The supposed animal was half bird and half reptile. Dr. Gould here says that curious mosaics like Archaeopteryx do not count. The reason he says that is because Archaeopteryx was not a transitional fossil, but a mosaic fossil. A transitional structure would be, say, an animal with half legs and half wings, or half scales and half feathers. But Archaeopteryx had feathers and wings which were completely functional. They were not transitional at all. And the same with all other fossils. All of their structures are fully functional. None of them are transitional structures anywhere in the fossil record. Dr. Mark Ridley now, let me read an interesting statement from him in the New Scientist magazine in 1981. He is professor of zoology at Oxford University, the great British university. Speaking of the fossil record, he says, in any case, no real evolutionist, whether he's a gradualist or a punctuationist, uses the fossil record as evidence in favor of the theory of evolution as opposed to special creation. So he says you can't use the fossil record to show evidence for evolution. As we just pointed out, the reason why you can't is because there are no transitional forms in it. Out of the billions of fossils that have been documented, no transitional forms have ever been found. Darwin, way back when he wrote his book, said that was the main problem with his theory of evolution, that there were no transitional forms in the fossils. But he thought that given enough time, they would discover all these transitional forms in the fossil record. Well, since Darwin's time, they estimate that something like 99% of all the fossils that we now know have been discovered since Darwin's time. But again, there are no transitional forms in any of them. The same gaps exist today that existed in Darwin's day. And the reason is, we creationists believe, of course, is because transitional forms never existed. What we see in the fossil record is exactly what we would expect to see if each kind was specially created with its own structure for its own purpose, the ability to vary horizontally within the kind, but never to be transmuted into some other kind, particularly some higher kind, although in some cases they may go downhill towards atrophy and distinction, but never into any higher kind. And what we see in the fossil record is exactly what we'd expect to see in the case of creation. So the fossil record, the record of the past, gives good scientific evidence for creation, just as does the evidence in the present. The scientific case for creation is strong in the systems of the present. If anything, it's even stronger in the record of the past. And then the next thing we want to consider is evolution even possible at all, and we want to therefore consider what possible changes can take place in the real world of real plants and animals. On the other hand, what we see in both the present and in the past is exactly what we would predict on the basis of special creation of the basic kinds of organisms with their own particular structures for their own purposes, the ability to vary within the kinds, to adapt to different environments without becoming extinct, but never able to be transformed or evolved into some higher kind. And there are no transitional forms either in the present world or in the past world, as we have just been discussing. Now, that raises the question, is evolution even possible at all? That means what kind of changes can take place. Interestingly enough, it's now known that the two basic laws of science that govern all processes, biological, physical, chemical, geological, any type of natural process, the two basic laws that govern these processes deal with this very subject, what kinds of change can take place. These are also called the first and second laws of thermodynamics. Or the first law is called the law of energy conservation, and the second law, the law of entropy increase. Now, I need to define those terms if you're not familiar with them. But basically, these laws support our belief that evolution is not even possible at all. Let me once again quote from leading evolutionary authorities. However, the first man I want to quote from is a very widely read columnist who is an evolutionist, but not a scientist. He's a journalist. But he's dealing with this question. He says, there is a factor called entropy in physics indicating that the whole universe of matter is running down and ultimately will reduce itself to uniform chaos. This follows from the second law of thermodynamics, which seems about as basic and unquestionable to modern scientific minds as any truth can be. At the same time that this is happening on the physical level of existence, something quite different seems to be happening on the biological level. Structure and species are becoming more complex, more sophisticated, more organized, with higher degrees of performance and consciousness. Of course, Mr. Harris is simply quoting what evolutionists say on this. Nobody's ever seen this happen, as we've been pointing out. But then he goes on to say, well, how can the forces of biological development and the forces of physical degeneration be operating at cross purposes? It would take, of course, a far greater mind than mine even to attempt to penetrate this riddle. I can only pose the question because it does seem to me the question most worth asking and working upon with all our intellectual and scientific resources. Our other quests seem trivial and time-bound compared with the fate of our species and of all the life in the universe. Yeah, is everything really running down towards destruction and death and decay and disintegration? Or is everything evolving towards higher levels, as evolutionists believe? Well, that's the question, and the response, of course, that we would have to make is that these laws of thermodynamics, which point downward, are laws of science. Evolution is not a law of science. It's simply a belief exercised against all the scientific evidence. And we would say it would be better to go with science. The scientific laws of change seem to say that evolution is impossible. But let me define the laws again a little more explicitly. Here, let me quote from Isaac Asimov, who's one of the nation's leading evolutionists. Admittedly, he says he's an atheist. He's the president of the American Humanist Association. Here he's discussing the first law, or the law of energy conservation. He says, energy can be transferred from one place to another or transformed from one form to another, but it can be neither created nor destroyed. Or we can put it in another way, the total quantity of energy in the universe is constant. This law is considered the most powerful and most fundamental generalization about the universe that scientists have ever been able to make. This is the best law that science has. Energy, which means the capacity to do work, everything that happens involves energy changes. Energy is converted from one form into another, and things happen then. Everything that happens involves energy changes. Energy is being converted from one form to another, but the first law of science, or the first law of thermodynamics, says that energy can neither be created nor can it be annihilated. It is conserved. Now, this implies that the energy of the universe, which includes all the matter of the universe, has either always been here just like it is now, or that it was specially created because it could not have created itself. In the present structure of the universe, nothing is being created. Then we come up against the second law, which says that the universe has not always been here because everything now is running down. Here's what Asimov says about that. He says, another way of stating the second law is that the universe is constantly getting more disorderly. We can see the second law all about us. We have to work hard to straighten up a room. But left to itself, it becomes a mess again very quickly, very easily. Even if we never enter it, it becomes dusty and musty. How difficult to maintain houses and machinery and our own bodies in perfect working order. How easy to let them deteriorate. In fact, all we have to do is nothing, and everything deteriorates, collapses, breaks down, wears out all by itself. That's what the second law is all about. This second law of science, a universal law of science, if anything is such a law, says that everything tends to go down towards disintegration, deterioration, breaking up, decaying, dying. Now, we know this is true. We see it in our own lives all every day. We know that things just don't naturally get better. You have to do something outside of them to make them get better. If they just are left to themselves, they'll go down. And yet, evolutionists seem to think that over millions of years, the universe left to itself has evolved from primeval hydrogen gas into complex worlds and animals and people all by itself. Now, we maintain that that's exactly contrary to the second law of thermodynamics, which is a law of science. Are there any exceptions to this? Well, let me quote now from Frank Greco in an article in the American Laboratory in 1982 on this subject. He says, being a generalization of experience, the second law could only be invalidated by an actual engine. That is, it's based on the fact that we always see it work. If we could ever find an example when it didn't work, then we would know that it could be violated. He says, in other words, the question, can the second law of thermodynamics be circumvented, isn't well worded and could be answered only if the model incorporated every feature of the real world. But an answer can readily be given, he says, to the question, has the second law of thermodynamics ever been circumvented? Not yet. No one's ever seen an exception to it. If there is such a thing as a law of science, this is it. And it said everything goes downhill, not uphill, towards higher levels of complexity. Sometimes when we talk about this, evolutionists will say, well, creationists don't know what, they don't understand thermodynamics. They don't realize that these laws apply only to closed systems. Well, the fact is they apply to open systems. That is, systems that are open to outside sources of energy and matter. The equations become a little more complex when the systems are open instead of closed, but they still apply. Let me quote here from an article in Chemical and Engineering News, 1980, by Dr. John Ross, who, when he wrote this, was at Harvard University. He says, there are no known violations of the second law of thermodynamics. Ordinarily, the second law is applied or is stated for isolated systems, but the second law applies equally well to open systems. There is somehow associated with the field of far from equilibrium phenomena the notion that the second law of thermodynamics fails for such systems, but it's important to make sure that this error does not perpetuate itself. In other words, the law of decay applies to open systems as well as closed systems. Now, it is true that in an open system, you can do certain things from outside that system to make it remain steady or even to go uphill for a while. You can make water go uphill if you put a pump in the line, for example. And you can make a seed grow up into a tree if you have the seed already there and then you provide the proper environment for it and so on. Or you can make a pile of bricks grow up into a building if you do certain things to them. But they don't do that by themselves. They have to have very special energy sources applied and very special directions applied. In other words, to have an increase of organized complexity in any kind of a system, whether it's an open system or a closed system, you have to have a directing program of some kind telling it how to grow, how to organize itself, or how to be organized. You have to have a blueprint for the building. You have to have the genetic code for the seed and so on. Else it won't grow. And then besides that, you have to have some kind of a complex system or maybe a complex of systems of conversion mechanisms to convert the raw energy of the outside world, say coming in from the sun, into the complex work of building up the structure of the plant or of the building or whatever it is. There must be both a code and a mechanism in order to offset the second law of thermodynamics even in an open system. What about the age-long process of evolution? There is no code. Nobody knows of any kind of a program that tells evolution how to happen. It's supposed to happen by chance. And there's no conversion mechanism. There's no known mechanism to make evolution work. Evolutionists have been trying to find a mechanism for a long time, but they still say that's the central mystery of speciation or central mystery of biology, as I quoted from Dr. Ridley. They don't know how it works. There's no mechanism. There's no code. And therefore, without a code and a mechanism, evolution must obey the second law of thermodynamics, which means it won't work. Things will go downhill. That's why we see plenty of evidence of extinction in the world, but no evidence of speciation or of new species evolving out of lower species. We see plenty of evidence of atrophy, degeneration, mutations cause things to become deformed and so on. But never do we see it going in the opposite direction. This is because the laws of change are obeying the second law of thermodynamics. Now, of course, these laws of thermodynamics or laws of science, if there is such a thing, maybe there could be an exception to them. We would maybe call it a miracle if we saw an exception ever happen. God, who is the creator, can intervene in any laws which he created if he so chooses. But there must be good reason and good evidence. In the normal course of nature, that doesn't happen, and things do go downhill. They do not go uphill. Evolutionists insisted we should believe that evolution is a fact of science, but we see no evidence in the present, no evidence in the past. And now we see that based on the laws of science, there's no evidence it's even possible at all. And that's, of course, why we don't see any evidence in the present or in the past, is because it's even possible. Now, on the other hand, these laws of thermodynamics do testify to creation. They're not just problems for evolution, because they're exactly what we'd expect to see if the world had been created in the past. we would expect to see a principle of conservation applied. When the Creator finished his work of creation, he would want it to be conserved, so he would impose on it a principle of conservation. So it would not just collapse and deteriorate and become chaotic. And so the law of conservation, the first law of thermodynamics, is the most universal law of science. But then also we would say that if there are any vertical changes that take place, they cannot go uphill because the Creator would make everything perfect to begin with. For its own purpose, every organism would be designed to accomplish its purpose with its proper structure and system. And so we would expect to see any vertical changes, if they do take place at all, in a downhill direction, not uphill. That's, of course, exactly what we do see. And that's now been expressed in terms of the second law of thermodynamics, again, a universal scientific law. So the laws of thermodynamics point back to creation. The first law says the universe could not create itself. The second law says it must have been created, otherwise it would already be dead because it's in the process of decaying and dying. This is a worldwide process. The universe is going downhill towards an ultimate heat death, as they call it. It isn't dead yet, therefore it isn't infinitely old. There must have been a creation, but the universe could not create itself by the first law. It must have been created by the second law. The only rational answer to that is that it was created by an agency outside of itself able to create a universe. And the best way of stating that is, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. So the laws of science point back to creation. We've shown that there is no evidence for evolution in the present, no evidence in the fossil record of the past, and then no evidence that evolution is even possible at all in terms of the basic laws of science. Well, then a good question is, well, then why do evolutionists insist on believing in evolution? What is their evidence? What is the scientific case for evolution? Well, sometimes they would point out that there are certain similarities. Man and the ape look something alike. And the limb of the horse and the limb of the bat are somewhat homologous. And so they talk about these similarities as being evidence of evolution. In other words, different kinds of circumstantial evidences. One of these evidences is the evidence of vestigial organs. That is, there are certain organs that are now useless that once were useful in a previous evolutionary stage. They used to say that there were about 180 or so in man that were vestigial, that had been useful in some previous stage of evolution. But let me quote from an article by Dr. S.R. Scadding in the journal Evolutionary Theory, 1981. He says, as our knowledge has increased, the list of vestigial structures has decreased. Wiedersheim could list about 100 in humans. Recent authors usually list 4 or 5. Even the current short list of vestigial structures of humans is questionable. Anatomically, the appendix, for example, shows evidence of a lymphoid function. The coccyx serves as a point of insertion for several muscles and ligaments. A semilunar fold of the eye aids in the cleansing and lubrication of the eyeball, and so on. So nowadays, there's really no provable vestigial organ. But even if there were, that's very poor evidence for evolution. This is evidence for downhill changes in accordance with the second law of thermodynamics, as we've discussed, not uphill changes. So this is hardly any evidence for evolution. As far as similarities, similar anatomies, similar embryologies, by the way, the old recapitulation theory that the development of the embryo in the womb recapitulates the evolutionary history of the species. They used to call it ontogeny, recapitulates phylogeny. That has been disproved so thoroughly so long ago that no knowledgeable evolutionist would use it today at all. But they do say that there are certain similarities in embryos and that this is evidence that they have a common ancestor. Similarities of anatomy or of embryology are nowadays, they're more commonly focusing on different biochemicals, different proteins, similarities in proteins, and in the have worked out what they call a molecular clock, how long it takes certain proteins to mutate, and this is an index of how long ago the species diverged from each other. Now, we don't have time to discuss this in detail, but let me just give one quotation from Dr. Michael Denton in his book Evolution, A Theory in Crisis. He says, thousands of different sequences, protein and nucleic acid, have now been compared in hundreds of different species, but never has any sequence been found to be in any sense the lineal descendant or ancestor of any other sequence. Now, we could discuss that at great length, and it has been discussed in other programs and other meetings by creationists, but we don't have time here. Just note that even at the very most, even if there are certain similarities, what does this prove but common design? You would expect, for example, that there would be much more similarity in the chemistry of an ape and a man than of a man and a spider, for example. So the fact that the protein structure, the amino acid structure and so forth, is more closely similar in the ape to the man than in the spider to the man is exactly what we'd expect. Similarities, in other words, do not prove common ancestry, but common design. Design of similar structures for similar functions. The fact that man and fishes have eyes, for example, doesn't prove they have a common ancestor, but that they both needed to see, and so the Creator created eyes for both of them. And to some degree, they're slightly different because they have slightly different purposes, but essentially they're similar, and this is exactly what you'd expect. So that these similarities, these circumstantial evidences, are surely just as good evidence for creation as for evolution. In fact, much better, because creation can explain the differences. Evolution might be able to explain similarities, but it can't explain the differences. How'd they ever get to be different if they evolved from the same ancestor in the same world by the same process? But creation of similar structures for similar purposes, different structures for different purposes, this explains all of this very, very well. Well, what then is the evidence for evolution? Let me quote from a recent article by Dr. Stephen Jay Gould, Harvard University, probably the nation's top evolutionist, at least in terms of publications and awareness. And here's what he says. He says, our confidence in the fact of evolution, this is in Discover magazine, by the way, in 1987, our confidence in the fact of evolution rests upon copious data that fall roughly into three great classes. First, we have the direct evidence of small-scale changes in controlled laboratory experiments of the past 100 years. On bacteria, on almost every measurable property of the fruit fly Drosophila, or observed in nature, color changes in moth wings, development of metal tolerance in plants growing near industrial waste heaps, or produced during a few thousand years of human breeding in agriculture. So that's his first evidence, the evidence that we have small changes. Well, the fact is, that's exactly what the creationist predicts. Changes, varieties within the kind to adapt to different environments. And I think it's more significant that the changes in bacteria are so small that we have the same bacteria today that they have in the rocks of the Cambrian period, say, a billion years ago. They haven't changed that much. And as far as the fruit fly, of course, this little fruit fly, Drosophila, has been subjected to all sorts of mutation pressures to make, since they do reproduce rapidly, you can get a lot of change quickly in a short time. And so, well, let me just give this quote from Jeremy Rifkin in his book, Algen. He says, the fruit fly has long been the favorite object of mutation experiments because of its fast gestation period, 12 days. X-rays have been used to increase the mutation rate in the fruit fly by 15,000%. Scientists have been able to catalyze the fruit fly evolutionary process such that what has been seen to occur in Drosophila is the equivalent of many millions of years of normal mutation and evolution. Even with this tremendous speed-up of mutation, scientists have never been able to come up with anything other than another fruit fly. They've changed the fruit fly a little bit, but it's still a fruit fly. It isn't a horse fly or a house fly or a mosquito or something else. So these small changes prove nothing at all. And yet, Gould says that's one of his proofs of evolution. Then his second one, we have direct evidence for large-scale changes based on sequences in the fossil record. Well, we discussed that. There's no transitional form in the fossil record, and Gould himself has said so in other articles. And yet he thinks that the fossil record taken as a whole indicates evolution because we can arrange it in a series. Well, of course, we can arrange anything in a series, automobiles and anything else, doesn't prove evolution. And he now says evolution is not a ladder but a bush, and we have to realize that, so we can't arrange any kind of a straight evolutionary series. Says, since the fossil record is so imperfect, we can't hope to find evidence for every tiny twiglet. Well, that's an absurd statement because it's not the tiny twiglets we're looking for. We're looking for the branches. We're looking for any kind of an evidence of transition from one to another, and there is none. But then he says, third, and most persuasive, and here's his main evidence, we have the signs of history preserved within every organism, every ecosystem, and every pattern of biogeographic distribution by those pervasive quirks, oddities, and imperfections that record pathways of historical descent. Now, in other words, he says that the main evidence for evolution is the existence of imperfections in animals and plants. But, of course, we would respond to that, that that's a very strange evidence of evolution. Well, these are in the direction of decay in accordance with the law of entropy or the second law of thermodynamics, like vestigial organs. These are downhill changes, not uphill changes, and they don't begin to explain how the positive changes could take place that lead towards greater adaptation and greater complexity. And that's the only proof that evolution has. Evolution has no proof at all. Well, let me conclude by reading a statement from Dr. Wolfgang Smith in a new book, Teilhardism and the New Religion. Now, Dr. Smith is apparently a creationist, but he's not a fundamentalist Baptist or anything of that sort. He's a Roman Catholic, and he's a professor at Oregon State University, and is a very highly qualified and experienced scientist. And in his book, he says this, "We're told dogmatically that evolution is an established fact, but we're never told who established it, or by what means. We're told often enough that the doctrine is founded upon evidence, and that indeed this evidence is henceforward above all verification, as well as being immune from any subsequent contradiction by experience. But we're left entirely in the dark on the crucial question wherein precisely this evidence consists. The salient fact," he says, "is this. If by evolution we mean macroevolution, then it can be said with the utmost rigor that the doctrine is totally bereft of scientific sanction. To be sure, given the multitude of extravagant claims about evolution promulgated by evolutionists with an air of scientific infallibility, this may sound strange. Yet the fact remains that there exists to this day not a shred of bona fide scientific evidence in support of the thesis that macroevolutionary transformations have ever occurred. There's no evidence of evolution, no scientific evidence of evolution anywhere in the present, the past, the possible, and the evidence of things as they are. The evidence all points to special creation. It's the most amazing thing that evolution has been touted as scientific fact in all the universities and schools of the world, practically, when there has no scientific evidence at all. Well, we have to continually make this point wherever we can that the scientific evidence supports creation. There is a good, solid scientific case for creation. Now, the Bible teaches creation, of course, but so does the scientific evidence, and we need to make that point.